You're listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, where we shine light on the dark side of Christianity and how it affects people and communities. I'm Robin Mitchell Stroud, and I'm here with my co-host, Deborah Levy Martinelli. We'll be covering a variety of topics, from individual survivor stories, including our own, to the influence of religion on our national politics. To learn more about the podcast, visit our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or connect with us on TikTok and Instagram at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. Now, on to the show.
Hi, everyone.
Hey, everybody.
Here we are, The Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We wish you all a belated happy 4th of July. Hope it was a good one. But it made us think what we want to talk about next, and that is spiritual independence, something that Robin and I talk about a lot, and she's been teaching me a lot about it. So I'm going to ask her to define that for us to get us started today.
Ooh, that's hard. Defining it is hard, and here's why. Hi, everybody, by the way. It's a process. And it is a process that is different for everyone. Depending upon, you know, who you talk to, they have different definitions of it. I would say, since we have a framework in our podcast of, well, religious imprisonment, the impact of that is religious and spiritual abuse and neglect. And one definition for spiritual abuse is the act of making a person believe they will be punished in this life or tormented in a kind of a hellfire forever if they fail to live in the way that God requires. And lots of carceral churches, you know, perpetuate this. There's more to it involved in that. So freedom from that would be one definition of spiritual independence, but it is truly a process. And so one of the things that I think could be helpful to talk about today are just some of the keys for going through that process. There are many different keys for release, keys for independence, keys for freedom. So how about we kind of approach it from that perspective?
Let's do that. And I think as I think about what I believe is going to be our first key in sort of a chronological fashion, because as you said, it's a process. It's a quest for your own identity and sense of self. So that is very like to me a lot of therapy and, I don't know, therapeutic groups. And what you have to do to conquer a problem is to identify it first.
Yes, that's interesting that is the way that you use identity. I wasn't even thinking of that. I kind of like it. But yes, that is precisely it. You come to some awareness of your prison, right? I mean, like when we're really young and we're just grow up in the prison, we don't really have an awareness that it's a prison because it's our normal. So at some point, people who are within a religious prison, people like me, and Deborah, you know that the word that I use for people like me, the word is carceralites. The identity that I've given people who were raised in religious imprisonment is a carceralite. And of course, I like that because it's a kind of a blend of biblical and penal, you know, milieus. But anyway, that awareness that you are in a prison and that awareness that that it's not okay anymore is huge. And but even if you're aware of it, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to do anything about it. It's like you have to be able to be willing to sort of be curious and start to look outside the prison for other things. So yes, I would agree that one of the keys is awareness. And that's actually a really, really important one. It's a big one. And then another piece of that is being willing then to sort of branch beyond that and look for other things. And that is really, really scary when you're being raised in a carceral religious environment, because there are, there's punishment for that. Like, you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to look outside. You're just supposed to believe and kind of stay where you are. So yes, questing for your own identity is huge. And then I would say another one is being courageous enough to start to look externally. And then another huge piece of that, another key, and I know you and I've talked about this before, is getting to the point where you are okay with questioning or challenging your beliefs. And then, you know, oh my goodness, even better. So when you're in the prison, you start to question and you feel guilty about, I mean, lots of carceralites even feel guilty about the questioning. But then being willing to challenge those, and then when you move beyond to replace them with something else, is really key. Deborah, I was reading something yesterday, the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which was ratified in 1989 by every country in the world besides Somalia and the United States, by the way, outlines the fundamental freedoms and inherent rights that human beings are born with. And because, you know, they want to protect those rights. Anyway, Article 14 declares respect for the child's freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. And so it's like in an educative environment, we would be encouraging kids to question. We would be encouraging kids to challenge. We wouldn't be afraid to open up our own, you know, set of beliefs and let them grab what they like and leave what they don't. But not every religious environment, not every church, not every family lets you do that. And there's a penalty to be paid in certain environments where you're not allowed to do that. So it's big. To question is a huge key. To get to the point where you're willing to do that and challenge is a big key.
So that brings up the very salient point, I think, of when do you reach that point? You know that you are in prison. When do you reach that point? I suspect it is different for every individual. Give us an example or two of when you reach that point, what makes you want to go question, or what makes you brave enough to start questioning?
Yeah, it's different for different people. It may be that their own internal suffering moves them to do that work. It also could be, and that was a huge piece of it for me. I just had gotten to the point where I was so unhappy, and not even unhappy. That's not even a strong enough word. There are just so many ugly, deep emotions that finally caused me to look external. And then I had to tap into a base of courage to help me to move, to actually do something about that. But for other people, it could be things like maybe they encountered certain people that caused them to finally go. There's a tipping point, and that tipping point could be caused by your own suffering. It could be caused by someone that you've encountered, either a positive force or somebody that's just challenged. Oh, I know I've shared this with you before. When I was in college, I had some friends who said, Robin, we really want you to talk to this guy. He really needs help, because I guess I had a reputation for being sort of the most pious in our group, which is fine. That part's fine. But like, I was so uncomfortable proselytizing to people. I can't believe that I ever agreed to even talk to this guy. But we were in his car, we were sitting, and I was trying to, you know, I was proselytizing to him. And he stopped me in mid-sentence, and he said, well, what color was Jesus? And I just was so taken aback by that question. And I don't remember if I said white. I think I just paused so long that he said something like, you know, I'm sure you think he's white, but he was Middle Eastern, so how could he be white? Middle Eastern men are not white. And I walked away. That just had me gnawing. Like, I could not shake that question, because I did not know what color Jesus was, because no one had ever bothered to ask me. The Jesus that I grew up with is the white Jesus with the blue eyes and, you know, and the pictures that hung in my church. So it could be those kinds of encounters with people that challenge you, that cause you to start to question. It may be encounters with educational materials you know, that you just happen to stumble across. But it's just a whole lot of different things. And maybe it's also for some people their own, you know, like they just, maybe they seek out mentors, you know, maybe they've sought out people who can help them do that work. But it is different for different people.
In the case of one of our previous guests, Kenlyn Colleen, she talked about an educator who was so brilliant and yes. so impactful in her thinking that that is where she started to think very differently about her incarceration and her deconstruction. Talk to us a little bit more about that.
About Kenlyn's experience with that?
Yes.
Yes, Kenlyn was, and this was so surprising to me, she was in college at Oral Roberts University in Oklahoma, which is a very conservative Christian college in Oklahoma. And it was a teacher at her college that encouraged them to critically think. I mean, for lack of a better way of saying it, encouraged them to be critical thinkers. And the great part about that is that Kenlyn was explaining to us that if she had gone to a big, you know, public university, she may have kind of dug in and been defensive about her beliefs. So being in a conservative Christian college environment and being given permission, it was a male teacher too, by the way, which is added, it's an added emphasis because he's the male authoritative figure. But having a male Christian teacher basically say, it's okay to question, is what prompted her. I mean, it was like that would, that gave her permission to do that, which is, you know, that's an unexpected way of coming at it. That's why I mean, like everybody's journey is so different.
So for some people, it opens the floodgates. An experience like that would open the floodgates and have you perhaps question and be curious about everything that you've been taught.
Yes. And you know, that has come up a lot in my research. For many people, it's like a slow and steady process. That's what it's been for me. I've been, spiritually independent for a long time, but I'm still gaining spiritual freedom in my own head, in my own heart. I've just been working at that my whole life because I think we all do. We don't maybe realize that we're doing that, but we're always working on perfecting our soul. And so anyway, for some people, it's like that. It's like an experience in the way that John Dewey talks about an experience where it's kind of bounded and deeply meaningful and very impactful. And for other people, it's the slow and steady kind of build, which is what it was for me. But I was also so deeply incarcerated. Like I consider myself to be, you know, to have grown up in sort of a maximum incarceration, maximum religious incarceration, that probably that being released or achieving my spiritual independence by degrees was helpful. I needed that because I had so many wounds to heal that I couldn't have done all of that work kind of in one fell swoop. So yeah, the process can be jump-started by those kinds of experiences that Kenlyn had, or the process can be slow and steady like it was for me, because I needed that to be able to give my, you know, give my spirit and everything time to catch up, spirit, mind, body, you know, soul, all of it. My conscience, you know, it's like I had to give myself permission to follow my conscience, which is, that's another one of our keys, right? You and I talk about this a lot, is just knowing that it's okay to follow our own religious and spiritual conscience. And Deborah, you and I talk too, that doesn't feel good. That doesn't, when you're coming to spiritual independence, that feels wrong. You feel like you're doing something bad. So one of the keys is to feel that feeling, just witness it, allow it, and then release it and keep going, right?
Yeah. So you feel guilty and you own that guilt and you move on.
And you move on. Yep. And you just keep going. And you're going to feel that you're going to feel feelings more than once as you're trying to achieve spiritual independence. So just feel it. acknowledge it, witness it, and move on. Yeah, keep going.
And when you talk about spiritual independence and spiritual freedom, and I won't use those interchangeably because I know you make a very clear distinction.
I do.
But I want to, yes. Well, it's very scholarly, which is who you are. But I think it's important to note that the spiritual independence could mean any kind of situation in your life. It's not necessarily a religious experience.
That's true. It's anything that heals your spirit or your soul. It's any step you take or any, you know, thinking that you do. It's all of those things that we do to try to get to our inner sanctuary. And that's not bound by religion. So yes, you're absolutely right.
For example, some instance where you feel guilt and fear of not pleasing someone else. You're doing everything for someone else.
Yeah.
And one day you think, I can't do this anymore. I need to do what's best for me. That is a spiritual experience, but certainly not necessarily a religious one.
And that's a spiritual wound, right? Because why are we working so hard to be enough or to be worthy for other people? I define those as original wounds. When we feel like we have to do in order to be worthy of love, right? We are inherently worthy of those things just by being. So yeah, those original wounds can originate within a religious kind of framework or just from being human, right? And so, yeah, part of the spiritual independence journey is grappling with those kinds of spiritual wounds and healing them, which, you know, there are lots of different avenues that people, I think we talked about this in an earlier episode, but there are lots of different things that people do that. And it could be within religion or it doesn't have to be. It could be prayer and meditation. It could be attending service, but it could also be running or, you know, my oldest brother, Robbie, loves to hunt, but it's not about the hunting. It's about sitting in nature for hours and hours. And that heals him that, you know, in some deep inner way. So we don't have to define what that means for people. The choices are kind of endless.
I want to get back to what we started to talk about, and that's curiosity and exploration, which is another key for religious and spiritual release. And you told me just yesterday about something you had read, something you had heard about curiosity as a privilege.
Yeah. This was mind blowing. I was listening to a podcast episode with Brené Brown, and she was interviewing Oprah, and oh my goodness, I can't remember this gentleman's name. He's a neuroscientist, I believe, but they just published a book that I think is called What's Wrong With You? And essentially there were lots of parallels there for the kind of work that I do, but the title is inspired by the fact that, you know, sometimes when we see how people are behaving, we go, what's wrong with them? Instead of asking, what happened to you? Oh, I think that may be the name of the book, What Happened to You? So anyway, here's the deal. If you feel safe and loved, your brain becomes able to explore and be curious. But if you are frightened, it all it's trying to do is sort of in survival mode. It's trying to manage feelings of fear and, you know, and abandonment and some other things. But when you grow up in carceral Christianity, which is what I call it, religious imprisonment, that's all grounded in fear and, you know, like, feelings of fear, it's fear and shame and guilt. And all of that keeps us tied into just trying to manage that. So when you grow up in that kind of environment, being able to be curious and having the freedom to explore is a privilege. So if you're a person listening to this podcast and you're like, well, why don't they just leave? And why don't they just go figure this out on their own? Well, you're speaking from a place of safety privilege, I'm going to call it. And that is hard to, like, for me, when I first left my church, I wasn't even there yet. I didn't feel safe enough to really do the deep exploring. And for me, it's been a process of decades. That's why, like, when I talk about my spiritual independence journey, and the reason that I distinguish independence from, you know, true freedom is just because I grew up in a religious prison. And I left that prison. So I'm free. I'm like, I've been liberated from the prison, but I still have these wounds and things that I'm dealing with that don't make me spiritually free. And being curious enough, feeling safe enough to be curious and explore is a privilege of growing up in an environment that encourages questioning and all of that good stuff. So yeah, that is a key. One of the keys for spiritual release is knowing that it is okay to be curious. It's okay to explore. It's okay. And I know that this is another one we talk about a lot is study other religions and philosophies and perspectives and take what you like and leave what you don't. I mean, I still identify as a Christian, right? Because that's the kind of the person that brought me to the dance, so to speak. But I'm religiously eclectic, meaning that I take what I like from all kinds of different religions, because religions have so much more in common than we do, you know, different. So I take what I like from different religions, and then I'm spiritually fluid. So maybe 1 month I'm feeling more like I want to meditate, and another month I feel like I want to, you know, read, or another month I may be more journaling, whatever it is that feeds my spirit, that's okay. So one of the keys is just knowing that it is okay to do these other things. Like, there's no wrong. It's okay to do them. It's okay to like study other things, and you don't have to do it in any kind of way or order. Like, it's all out there. It's all okay.
So things like reading and meditating may or may not be associated with a particular religion. Can you give us some sense of specific things that you have drawn from specific religions that are outside Christianity? Like, meditation is a big one, but there are different parts of your meditation.
That's true. I've never been the kind of person who can sit in silence and meditate. I have too much of a monkey mind, they call it, right? My brain is just going so fast. But I love guided meditations, and there are all kinds of guided meditations, some that are just for things like sleeping. You know, like, I always do a sleep meditation before I go to sleep at night. But some are guided meditations for really getting to your core inner landscape. But I would also say, going back to the reading, you know, I'm a scholar, so of course I read a lot. And one of the things that I did early on was I have a collection of sacred texts from all kinds of different religions. So if you were to walk into my library, you would see the Bible, you would see the Tao Te Ching, you would see the Quran, you would see like the Book of the Dead. Like, I have them all, and I like to read from all of them, because every religion's sacred text has, you know, really meaningful things that I can pull into my own spiritual life. But that's such a departure from, you know, when you grow up in a religious prison and they tell you what you should be reading, and they tell you what you should be, you know, what you should think and how you should believe. Like, that would have been really, really wrong, bad. If I wouldn't have, there were only, well, I kind of joke, we didn't really have very many books in my house growing up, but we had lots of Bibles. So lots of Bibles. The Bible was the okay book, but there's no way that we could have had, you know, sacred texts from other religions on our bookshelf, because it wasn't okay.
Well, and that too, I think, is part of the privilege. I went to a high school that was a big high school. We had more than 2,000 kids, and it was only sophomore, junior, senior. It was only 3 years and not four. But one of the classes that I took was Bible as Literature. And I was raised as a conservative Jew, not secular, to be sure. We were secular, but we were still a little bit to the right of the Reform movement. So there were things that we did that may or may not have made sense to me as I was growing up. But as most people, I just adopted and adapted. And I signed up for this class, and we were reading the New Testament. And I was like, wait, what? what are all these stories? I never knew about these stories. I didn't know that there were more, anything more than the Old Testament. And what Judaism typically focuses on are the first five books of the Bible, or the Torah, as we refer to it. So I'm reading all these stories by apostles about Jesus. And it was such a mind opener for me because of the kind of environment I grew up in my family and my community, but also the fact that I went to a large, diverse high school.
I think your point is a good one. There was like this whole other part of sacred text that you hadn't been exposed to. And, you know, one of the things that when I talk to other Christians, one of the things that I like to tell them is that, you know, Jesus shows up more in the Quran than he does in the Bible. And because he is a prophet, right? He's not the son of God. He's a prophet. And that always surprises people. But it's because, you know, they never took the time to really kind of explore that on their own, what the Quran is, what it means, you know, who Jesus is in the Quran. But also I was thinking about, I remember the first time, kind of like when you were talking about how you realized there was this other part of the Bible, because you were only, you grew up with the Old Testament part of it. And of course, where the church that I was raised in, we grew up with a lot of the New Testament part. And then of course, the commandments piece of the Old Testament, all of that. But when I was in college, I learned about things like the Nag Hammadi texts and other books that were not included in the canonized version of the Bible, including like the Gospel of Mary Magdala. And so I only grew up hearing that Mary Magdalene was like a prostitute and a whore and all those things. But if you read her book, she's anything but. She is an apostle, and she's, you know, a woman of religious and spiritual authority, and that was in given to her by Jesus himself. So anyway, there are just lots of books that were left out that even I was like, wow, this is amazing. But who decides, right? I mean, but also what we're doing right now, the fact that we're able to have a conversation about this and why we are only exposed to certain things and why things are left out and, you know, like all of that stuff. That's a privilege, because if you grow up in being an incarcerated Christian, this kind of questioning and interrogating of our own experiences is discouraged.
Or an incarcerated anything. I was reading a story the other day in the New York Times about a woman, and this is of great interest to me, the whole ultra Hasidic community, especially in the eastern part of the United States, New York and Brooklyn in particular. But there is a woman who has 10 children, ranging in age from infant to 21. And several years ago, she decided, you know, this wife and mother and cooking and cleaning, I get it. This is what I grew up in. I understand it. And so far, I've been fine with it and I've been happy with it. But I've always wanted to be a doctor. Is it possible for me to become a doctor? She went to her rabbi for counsel, and she and the rabbi figured out a plan whereby she could still take care of her family and go to medical school. And this woman has completed medical school. And she's now in a residency that is taking her family, which is a big family, and her husband does not have a job that keeps them grounded in their community. They're moving to a different part of the country for her residency, which has to be unheard of.
Wow.
In that community.
Yeah, I think that's extraordinary. And isn't that a good point that you just made? Because this is why it's really dangerous to try, you know, one of the things that I'm always really careful to point out is that when we talk about being incarcerated Christians, we're not taking a broad brush and, you know, painting all of Christianity, or like in your case, all of Judaism, right? It's not a broad brush criticism. There are communities and pockets that are harmful. So you can be in a more conservative, you know, theologically conservative branch of a religion, but the community itself can be quite liberating for you. And what she found was a supportive community, which is a real key, because when you like, if you're looking for a new place, it's, you know, for a lot of the people who have left the prison, we talked about this before, you sort of are unmoored and you're trying to find a community. Finding a community is really important. Finding your people is really important, whatever that means. And it makes me really happy to hear that she was supported within her
community. From a rabbi, an ultra-Orthodox male rabbi.
Yep.
It's astonishing to me.
And that's why, you know, we can't say that everyone and everything is bad about X, Y, or Z, right? It's context. It's our identity. It's our spiritual identity. It's our human identity in context. And in her context, she received support from an authoritative figure, which is awesome. You know, I have an example of an exact opposite. I guess it's an exact opposite example of that. So in this case, it's a woman in a Christian church who had lots of babies by a young age, I think 7, and she wanted to go on birth control. I spoke with this woman. She wanted to go on birth control. She couldn't make that decision for herself because that wasn't her decision to make according to the tradition that she was raised in. So she talked to her husband and he said no. So she asked if they could go talk to the pastor, and they did. They made a meeting they scheduled an appointment with the pastor, and she went in and this woman is worn out. So she's working full time. She has 7 kids, taking care of other family. She doesn't want any more babies, right? That should be her choice to make. But so they went to the pastor and she's pleading her case. And the pastor said, you have to do what your husband wants you to. So that is the exact opposite example of what you just offered. We should be able to make decisions for our own body and our own spirit and our own conscience, you know, and our own mind. And that would be, you know, an example of if we teach kids that it's okay to do that, or even teach adults how to do that, that would be a pedagogy of education for peace, peaceful education, I guess you would say. It's a very different way of being in the world when you have that freedom versus if you have to go through people to make those choices for yourself.
I'm just going to say one thing because it's a pop culture reference and then we will move on. But what you just said reminded me of something that is in the news every day, and that is Britney Spears and her conservatorship and how she is trying to break free of that. And one of the things that she says she is prevented from doing because of the conservatorship is having her IUD removed because she wants to have more kids and wants to have a family. And she's prevented from doing that because there is this legal entity that is controlling her life.
Oh my gosh. Seriously? I'm only peripherally aware of the whole Britney Spears conservatorship. That's just wrong. I mean, I don't know. That is wrong. That's like that to me feels like the same arguments that people try to make for sterilizing women. That is just wrong. So
it's imprisonment.
It is. And you know how crazy that is. Of course, the circumstances may be different, but it's also like when you either prevent women from taking birth control, right? Or you force them to have babies. It's like these are choices that women should be able to make for ourselves.
Which is a whole other discussion.
It is.
And
that's
a whole other argument. But that one aspect of pop culture, I call it pop culture because it is everywhere, that I just wanted to make.
No, I think that's a really good one. I will say that, you know, we talk about there is no like how to achieve spiritual independence. Step 1, step 2, step 3, step 4, right? But there are some signs that because once you get free, you still have to heal. That's the other thing. You know, our tagline is break free, heal, live a spiritually abundant life. And so there are signs that you are healing. For example, when you start to trust more and you have less fear, like that is such a small thing, but it is so hard to achieve when you start to, you know, trust more. Not only trust other people, But trust yourself. I mean, that's a huge piece of it too, is just trust that you can take care of yourself and trust that it's okay for you to follow your calling and your whatever that calling is. When you sort of get more clarity, you have less confusion about what to do, where to go. You know, like part of the process for me is even when I left, I still questioned, am I going to hell? Will God love me? You know, I'm like, I know that I didn't feel that love within the church, but I still wondered if I could achieve it even when I got out of the prison, right? But just getting more clarity of that, or feeling more peaceful about that, is a sign that you're healing. When you're able to be more self-reflective, when you're able to have self-compassion. For me, you know, we just talked about this. Last year was a whole deep dive into me about self-love. Like, I didn't realize that I didn't have holistic self-love. There were only parts of me that I loved, and there was, you know, parts that I felt indifferent to. So that's another sign you're healing, is that when you have more self-love. And just more trusting, more, you know what? Here's another one. I used to call myself a human doing, and it goes back to that original wound of, you know, not doing enough and not, you had to do a lot to be worthy. When you stop being a human doing and you just know it's okay to be a human being, that is a sign.
Can you be both? Because to me, you are such a doer, doing everything, going 90,000 miles an hour. So to me, you're kind of a human being and a human doing.
I think that's fair. And here's the difference, is that now I go into it with a different intention. Like, I do things now for me. I don't do them so that I can be worthy for other people. And that's huge. That's just a difference of, I have a lot of energy. Augie was just talking to me about this last night, our eldest son. He's just watching me fly around the house, right? And he's like, you need to rest more. And I go, I know I need to rest more. My schedule is always full. But I really enjoy what I'm doing. And I do these things a lot for either for me, or I do them for good reasons, the right reasons. And I'm not doing them because I don't feel worthy. I'm not doing them because I don't feel like I'm enough. I'm not doing them because I don't feel lovable and I feel like I needed to be worthy of love. And so that's a really, really different way of coming at that. But there are signs when you start to heal, there are those kinds of signs. And then you just can kind of, you know, enter a wider world. It's amazing. It's amazing when you get outside the prison, right?
It is amazing. And sometimes you get outside the prison, as you say, and maybe this goes to your distinction between freedom and independence. You're in that cage, then you're incarcerated. You step outside the cage, the door closes behind you. You're free from that cage, from that incarceration, but you right. haven't taken the journey, the complete journey to independence.
That's right.
Did I get that in the right order?
Well, I would do it the other direction, but it doesn't matter. It's the same point. Just because like, for example, I left the church, but I wasn't free. So, I mean, I wasn't like, I still, because I had all of these wounds, these original wounds, as I call them, you know, another sign of healing is just trusting your voice, like trusting your inner voice and then speaking that out loud, like using your voice. So like trusting my inner voice, which is my inner guide. And then using my words to speak those things out loud. That's huge. Being able to feel safe enough to express yourself is huge. Whatever that means. I mean, it could be about my religious and spiritual beliefs, but it could also just be about how I show up in the world.
Did you know when you were a child growing up in this incarcerated environment that you had an inner voice?
No, I didn't. I didn't know it at first. And then we were taught to be suspect of it, right? It's not about your inner voice, you know, and then it kind of messes with you because that might be Satan. Don't listen to that voice, right? I mean, so it could be demonized, or you just are made like you're just taught that it's faulty and that you need to be listening to these external authorities, including, you know, it could be people, but it's also the Bible as interpreted by people, right? I mean, it's you're taught everything is external to you. So that internal, your inner life, your inner sanctuary, your inner space, that inner guide, your inner light, like all of that is, you have to learn to be, to recognize it and then be okay with it and then externalize it. It's a process. It's just, and then, you know, the sort of the more you're traumatized, the harder that process is and perhaps the longer it takes, but it's just a lot of healing work to be done.
Are there concrete steps to doing this? I know it varies for everybody.
Yeah. Yes, there are people. There are, like, I can think of, there's a woman that whose podcast I listen to who teaches ex-Mormons. I think the podcast is called Ex-Mormonology. And her whole job is teaching people how to kind of escape. Well, for her, it's more, you know, growing up in the Mormon church and how you get beyond that. But I've listened to enough of her episodes to know that a lot of the, you know, steps that she outlines apply to anybody who feel like they are in a religious prison. And, you know, too, that that's one of the things that I want to focus on this year is writing out steps, like just generally the steps. But, and I think that there are things, there are steps. I would hate to try to venture them now. That's why I just feel like it's enough to offer some keys, but I would recommend people like that particular woman, because she's like a coach. She's like a spiritual independence coach for people who are trying to leave the Mormon church, but her coaching could apply to different religious experiences. So check her out. Ex-Mormonology is the name of the podcast. So yeah, there are people doing this kind of work, and eventually we want to do that kind of work.
So for now, we're not going to offer any steps. So let's get back to the keys. What's another good key?
Well, okay. So I think we've covered enough keys. And I would just say, you know, awareness is a huge first step. Here's another piece that we haven't talked about, but is key. But I don't think you get to this key until you do some of that other work first, kind of the exploring and the questioning and the being able to think critically and all of that. It's that one, another key, and this is a really important one, is learning to let go of fear, guilt, and shame. That's huge. And you and I talk about this even in our adult lives, with as much healing as we've done in our own, you know, in our own ways about different things, we still get triggered and it takes us right back there. So I'm not suggesting that there's a one and done on learning to let go of fear, guilt, and shame. And there are lots and lots of different things that kind of dovetail into that or layer into that. I don't know, address that. But that is a key that you have to learn to let go of that and instead embrace courage and compassion and hope and, really importantly, self-love. That is a key. And so, but it's okay if you've never heard anybody give you permission, listeners, it's okay to let go of that. And you know what's interesting? And I've talked with people who I've interviewed about this. When you grow up with apocalyptic beliefs and you just know, you've been taught that at any time Jesus is going to come and take the, you know, take the believers and leave everybody else. And when you're left behind, it's going to be in a really bad place. You're going to be left here with the Antichrist and all this other stuff. Even when you stop believing that, this is what I figured out. So that's the kind of beliefs that I grew up with. But even when I stopped believing that, like one time I got a mailer, and in our part of the country, it's not uncommon to get something in the mail that sort of triggers those kinds of beliefs. But I got something in the mail that, you know, was like, follow Jesus or, you know, die in a fiery pit of hell. And, you know, just, but it was worse than that. It was really like all of these different, you know, bad things that would happen. And it immediately triggered that really deep fear. So even when my mind doesn't believe it, sort of my body remembers that fear, and you have to remind yourself to release it. It's not real. It's okay. You know, but it's so powerful. Fear keeps us stuck. So we have to, you know, learn to be unstuck or learn to release ourselves.
I'm so glad you brought up that example, because you and I were talking about this just the other day. And I asked you, when something triggers you, even though you've done all of this work and you have let go of fear and guilt and shame, but things are going to happen and things are going to trigger you. And what you said to me was, if I know that the trigger is coming, essentially, you can prepare for it.
Yeah.
But if it's a surprise, like what you saw in the mail, you're instantly going to get triggered by it.
It's amazing that memory, that body memory, that, you know, that spirit memory. I don't know what you would call it, but, and that's why a fear-based religion, which is, you know, often also grounded in punitive, like a punitive discipline, it's punishments, right? Or rewards for being good and punishment for being bad. It's so powerful because it keeps us a bit in survival mode. It's like, what I have learned over the years is if I can anticipate it. So when I know, for example, that I'm going to go into a church for a family's funeral, I know I'm going to be, as part of that funeral service, there will be a sermon, and there's going to be a call, you know, like all of this stuff. But I can prepare spiritually, mentally, everything. I can prepare for that. And I'm sort of kind of, I've got my armor on, my inner armor on. But if I don't know it's coming, yes, it triggers. And but the difference is now I recognize it. And just the recognition of it helps you to sort of release it pretty quick. But it's amazing. It's just, to me, it just reminds me of how powerful the prison can be, how powerful it is. And it's not easy to escape it. So, you know that, and I know that very few people know this about me, but I'm about to tell anybody who knows me. When one of the things that I did when I got to a real place of spiritual independence is I got a tattoo to mark that. And while I was getting that tattoo, which was a symbol for kind of rebirth and renewal, and I got a koru, and it symbolizes rebirth and renewal and new life and things like that. I listened to Martina McBride's Independence Day on repeat. And, you know, it wasn't about, you know, I know a big part of that is about domestic violence being, you know, her achieving her character in that song, achieving independence from that. That's not what I mean. But there is spiritual violence, you know, spiritual abuse and neglect, religious abuse. There isn't, you do reach an Independence Day. I just gotten to a point where I'd done so much healing that I claimed it and marked it. So that was good. That was really good. It sort of marked my spiritual independence.
And Martina McBride, if you're listening, we would have loved to have used your song here, but we just can't afford to use it.
Can't afford to pay for the use of it. Yes, that would have been our anthem for today, right?
That's right.
Independence Day. Yeah. Well, and you know, one of the sayings on our website is, for long years, a bird in a cage, today flying along with the clouds. That's what spiritual independence feels like. So you just are a bird released from a cage in the clouds.
And isn't it interesting that that is a Zen saying? It does not come from Christianity or any Western religion. It's Zen.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why we grab from, you know, on our website, we would love for anybody to go check it out, theincarceratedchristian.com, but we have quotes on every page, and the quotes represent, you know, different religions. We've got one from a Jewish person, right? And then a Zen saying and an Islamic mystic, and even Nelson Mandela. I mean, it's just, we just grab quotes that speak to spiritual, religious and spiritual freedom, liberty, freedom. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we hope that outlining some of these keys is helpful to you. We'd love to know what you think about them. We'd love to know if you have others that you want to add. There are just, and we would love to, I would love too to know, you know, I've shared some signs of spiritual healing, but I would love to know when you started to recognize your own sense of religious and spiritual liberty and freedom and, you know, healing and well-being and all of those terms that you, what do you think?
I think that's all absolutely right. And listeners, you can find us on Twitter and on Instagram. And of course, please visit our website. We have a place there where you can contact us and share that sort of information with us, or just tag onto our social media. We would love to hear from you.
And happy Independence Day.
Yes, Martina McBride. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We invite you to rate and review our show. And remember, you can find this interview and others on our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or anywhere you access podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram and TikTok at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. You can find more information about us and our show on our website. Again, that's theincarceratedchristian.com. Until next time, go forth in love and light.